First of all, Shana Tova for any of you who are Jewish like me. Tonight is the Jewish New Year, which always falls on the new moon. Usually, so I get texts from family members and friends, you know, all these Rosh Hashanah texts. The message is usually the same. I wish you a sweet New Year. People wish you health, happiness, you know, the usual things people wish. Okay, so this year, I just wanted to say, I had half of the texts that included in the wishes sanity. Yeah, this is the first year anybody I know has ever wished sanity to everyone they love and to the world, which only goes to show you how insane everything is that Jews are running around this year wishing their loved ones sanity. Which is sort of a nice segue from last week to this week. Some of you may have been here last week, some of you may not have been here, but we talked a lot about the relationship of mindfulness and equanimity in order to bring about ability to know things as they actually are. So I thought that I would go a little deeper, but also a little more current. And I have a little help tonight from both the Buddha and Bhikkhu Bodhi. For any of you who don't know, one of our most dear, esteemed Theravada Buddhist teachers is a gentleman named Bhikkhu Bodhi. Many, many, many years ago became a monk and a translator, and much of the Pali Sutta translations have actually been written by him. And Bhikkhu Bodhi is not only an amazing scholar, but he is one of the few Buddhist teachers who is really, really clear about our responsibility to others in terms of hunger. He is the head of the Buddhist Global Relief, and he also is a big outspoken person about climate change. And he's very erudite, so when he does these things, he does them with great skill. I was looking for something else, actually, and I happened upon an article that he wrote 21 years ago, in 1998. And I started to read the article, and I was dumbfounded by how relevant it actually is for right now and everything we're experiencing right now. So I pulled out just three paragraphs from this article, and I thought I would begin by reading them to you because they really set the tone and the stage for what I want to share tonight. Bhikkhu Bodhi says, "When we approach the Buddha's teachings, we should bear in mind that its vast array of doctrines have not been devised as elaborate exercises in philosophical sleight of hand. They constitute right view, and right view stands at the head of the Eightfold Path. The chisel which cuts away the dross of wrong views and confused thoughts that impede the light of wisdom from illumining our minds. In the present day world," this is 21 years ago, his present day world, "wrong views have gained widespread currency and assumed more baneful forms than earlier epochs ever could have imagined. Today, they are no longer the province of a few eccentric philosophers and their cliques. They have become rather a major determinant of cultural and social attitudes, a molder of the moral spirit of the age, a driving force behind economic empires and international relations. Under such circumstances, right view is our candle in the dark. Without a clear understanding of the truths enunciated by right view, and without a keen awareness of the areas where these truths collide with popular opinion, it is easy to stumble in the dark or be swept away from one's own position." So For those of you who may not be familiar with the Eightfold Noble Path or what right view is, in a nutshell, after the Buddha's awakening under the Bodhi tree, he took about 3 weeks to figure out how the hell he was going to tell anybody about what happened to him, because he knew what he had realized really didn't have any frame at all back then about the nature of mind, the nature of suffering in the mind, and how to alleviate suffering in the human mind. So he sat there for 3 weeks and thought about it. And then he finally got up, and when he got up, then he went and he found his 5 friends who, 6 years prior to his sitting under the Bodhi tree, he had been engaged in Upanishadic yogic practices for 6 years. So he went and found them. As soon as he found them, they all sat down together and he gave the first Dharma talk, which is called the Four Noble Truths, which many of you probably know. So the first noble truth is there is an inherent unsatisfactoriness to all human experience. The second noble truth is the inherent unsatisfactory arises from 2 mental habits that we have that also are embodied in our DNA through evolution. We go toward pleasurable experience and we want it to continue because we think we need to have pleasurable experience in order to be happy and content. Or we run away from and avoid displeasurable experience because we think it will never end. Oh, we can't handle it. And we are always running back and forth between craving and aversion. These are the words the Buddha used in later schools of Buddhism. Hope and fear were also used to characterize these 2 inborn impulses we just appear to be driven by that cause us so much suffering. The third noble truth is there is a path to end being dragged around by your nose by craving and aversion. And the fourth noble truth is what's called the Eightfold Noble Path, which is these 8 steps a person can take in order to be able to awaken to the nature of the way things actually are. And the first of those steps is called right view. It's a little weird because, frankly, right view is a little hard to step right into. So at the start, right view may be merely conceptual understanding. Oh, I understand everything comes and goes. I can't hold on to any particular experience. So I will look for the coming and going, the impermanence in all things. Oh, I also understand that even though it feels like there's this little thing inside of me I call me, and then everything else outside of me, actually that's just a perceptual illusion. There is no separation between the coming and going of internal phenomena. It all arises interdependently, and that is called emptiness. The self is empty of separate existence, and all the things in the world are also empty of separate existence. But of course, over time, conceptual understanding with study and reflection, basically and usually some meditative practice, concepts about right view gradually become direct knowing of the way things actually are. And the attainment of right view is, at its core, essentially a matter of direct knowing. And direct knowing, I love this, in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, this is the way they describe direct knowing. They use the analogy of the moon. I've heard of the moon. There's this thing called the moon. I've heard of the moon. It rises when the sun sets. It lights things. It has this cycle that goes from nothing, like tonight. You can't see the moon tonight. It's a new moon. Very small, and then sliver, quarter, half. 3/4, up, and then full, and when it's full, it's big, and it has the face of a human being in it. Okay, that's conceptual understanding of what the moon is. But you have not seen the moon yet. And then, amazingly, one night, you're near a body of water, and your friend, who knows what the moon is, shows you the reflection of the moon in the water. You're, oh, that's the moon. This is the moon. I'm seeing the moon. So this is very much like what we did last week, these series of understandings, and they get better and better. And now you think you know the moon, but then all of a sudden your friend says to you, look up. And you look up and there's the actual moon. And now you really know the moon. So this is the way red view is. Over time, through your experiences, you get more intimacy with what it means to know things as they actually are. For householders like us, to me, red view at its core is a matter of understanding the things that trip you up. Because that's when you're going to meet red view right in the face, in the midst of something that makes you suffer. And depending on your relationship with it, how much you experience the reality of it, the less suffering you're going to have, the more you will be directly experiencing red view. This just is my opinion about it. Maybe that's because I'm a psychotherapist. I think that for us, this is a really good way to know directly right views. Certainly from the moon view in the lake. That's like real moon view in the lake. When you realize the pitfalls of wanting, aversion, and clinging to false views, it actually enables some of the other seven steps of the Eightfold Noble Path. Right intention, virtuous conduct, mental purification, wise livelihood, wise speech, wise effort. And then, of course, eventually you see the actual moon in the sky, which is unobstructed knowing, what we talked about last week, this unshakable deliverance of mind. So I'm going to shake your mind up a little bit now. Are you ready to have your mind shaken up a little bit? This will not be pleasant. I have been reading a book called The Uninhabitable Earth, Life After Warming. I don't know if any of you have read this book. It's fairly new. I thought I would give you a taste of what our future looks like. This book is a conservative view of what our future looks like. This is not overblown. This person is not going for the worst case scenario. In fact, he keeps trying to elicit the reader into, okay, I'm going to tell you the best case scenario. We may not have the best case scenario, but basically this is what I'm doing. At 51 degrees Fahrenheit of warming, more than half the world's population as distributed today would die of direct heat. But at just 41 degrees of warming, according to some calculations, whole parts of the globe would literally be unsurvivable for humans. At 42.8 degrees of warming, summer labor of any kind would become impossible in the lower Mississippi Valley, and everybody in the United States east of the Rockies would suffer more from heat than anyone anywhere in the world. New York City would be hotter than present-day Bahrain, one of the planet's currently hottest spots, and the temperature in Bahrain would, quote, induce hyperthermia in even sleeping humans, unquote. Yeah, you'd spontaneously combust in your sleep in Bahrain. 41 or 42 degrees of warming is unlikely by 2100, which is 80 years from now. The best case scenario for global warming is now between 35 to 36.5 degrees by 2100. Should I read that again? You thought we were going to be in the clear in 2100. No. So 41 or 42 degrees of warming is unlikely by 2100. The best case scenario for global warming is now between 35 to 36.5 degrees of warming by 2100. It's like 6 or 7 degrees less of warming. So 35 to 36.5 degrees of warming will lead to more deserts and food shortages because of increased drought. At least 6 feet of sea level rise, the permafrost melting at the poles and releasing methane stores of 100 billion tons of carbon, massive wildfires, intense storms, and freshwater source drain. So that's our best case scenario in 80 years. And there's no way to turn this around now. It doesn't matter what we do. So what does this mean for right view? Just take a moment and ask yourself, how do you bring right view to bear upon this? Our existence becoming something we've never known before as a species. Everything, all of our expectations for the way humans live, just gone. it's pretty overwhelming. So there are many ways, I think, to try to come to terms in some way with the disaster that we are facing. And it is a disaster. There's no two ways about it. You just can't. You can't paint it any other way. So one of the ways I do this is I like to hear from people who have a view about existence that is different than mine. And many times, those people are people who are in the sciences, particularly the sciences that deal with either the huge macro level of the cosmos, like cosmologists, or the infinitesimal, teeny tiny level, like the quantum physicists. Because at the big macro scale, the vastness, they know vastness. Somehow they do comprehend vastness that, frankly, I have trouble comprehending. So I like to listen to them talk about the vastness of the cosmos, the infinity of the cosmos, so I can try to see what is occurring right here, right now, with some other sort of view. And then, of course, that infinitesimal quantum reality, which frankly is so completely other than classical physical reality and is equally almost impossible to comprehend. So one of these people is Lenny Susskind. And Lenny is a professor of physics at Stanford. And he's one of the fathers of string theory, and he is a quantum physicist. And his father was a plumber in Brooklyn. And actually, he likes to say he didn't even know physics existed until he was 20, because he was a plumber with his father. I heard a recent interview, and the interviewer was talking to him about some of the things that he's worked on for a long time. And at one point, Lenny just stopped him and he said, look, everything is emergent, which frankly has a lot to do with global warming. I mean, this whole situation is emergent. It's all emerged from the ways that we have treated the planet. It's just come out of that. So then the interviewer asked Lenny, if we look at the deepest nature of reality, whether it is quantum mechanical or observed, what does this mean for our perception of having free will? And free will is very important when it comes to global warming, right? It appears as though there's nothing we can do to stop the scenario I told you because it's gone too far. How does human free will figure into this? So this is Lenny's answer. The illusion of consciousness, self, and free will, frankly, I'm puzzled by it. How can a physical system do this? An observer is a system with enough degrees of freedom that it can record information which can become entangled with the thing it's measuring. In quantum physics, measuring is knowing. So you can use knowing instead of measuring. Entanglement is the key. An observer system doesn't just look at phenomena, it becomes entangled with it. Now, does that satisfy me personally as an observer? He says. And then he says, yes and no. I like the mathematical representation of observing. We are quantum mechanically entangled with everything around us in this room right now. If we were not, then we would not be knowing it. However, I am uncomfortable in that my brain is not wired to directly experience that view of reality. Lenny Susskind is an awakened Buddha. I thought, yes, this is the problem. This is our problem with global warming. We cannot imagine this disaster that I have just told you is going to happen. I mean, mathematically, obviously, climate scientists and computers are fabulous computing AI friends. They can tell us exactly what's going to happen because computers are able to simulate what's going to happen. You just input all the conditions we've got and bam, there it is. It's not rocket science. On the other hand, we're not wired to directly experience entanglement the way we are part of what is emerging. And because we're not wired to directly experience it, we continue the suffering. This is why there's still people walking around saying there is no global warming. Why there are people driving cars that are not good for the planet. Why people are still eating massive quantities of meat, which is definitely not good for the methane on the planet. Why people just keep doing all the things we're doing because we do not have the view of entanglement directly. So as I was looking around for things the Buddha might have said in order to help us understand why global warming is so hard to understand for us, the first thing I thought was, well, the truth is, you know, the Buddha, at that time, they never really experienced anything like this. I mean, really, just sit back and think about it. We ourselves are causing the destruction of our world. 2,600 years ago, honestly, nobody had that power. Nobody even imagined they could destroy the entire planet. Like I said, they could go and wage war next door and destroy the culture. The entire world, the whole ecosystem, the thing human beings depend on, there's no frame for this in the suttas because those people didn't have it. Just like we cannot grok it. We cannot grok this. But in fact, as the Buddha is so marvelously capable, I did find a few suttas that helped. And the one I really liked the most, especially because of the end of this sutta. I've never heard a sutta end this way. Though we're going to talk a lot about the end. So this is the Mula Pariyaya Sutta, which is the sutta on the root sequence of phenomena. How's that for a scientific title for a sutta? The root sequence of phenomena. It's the very first sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. As usual, I have edited it down. It's gotten rid of all of the massive quantities of repeats, taking it right to its essence for you. So the Buddha was in Savatthi Grove, and he gathered all of the monks. And he said to the monks, I will teach you the secrets of the root of all phenomena. A non-practitioner perceives the earth as earth. Doing so, a non-practitioner conceives attributes of the earth, all the qualities of the earth, and everything that comes out of the earth. A non-practitioner knows all of these things. And yet, in that knowing, a non-practitioner views earth, its attributes, and everything that comes forth from the earth as me and mine. And this self-possessing view of earth creates clinging to and delighting in an experience of earth that impedes a non-practitioner's true understanding and direct knowing of the earth as it is. So what the Buddha is saying here is the view, me and mine, which to me is the entire crux of why we are in the situation we are in right now around global warming, is our view of me and mine. This earth is me, I get to direct what it does, and it's all mine. So that view means that people are viewing earth through the lens of permanence, safety, stability. There is a total inability to perceive the awful truth about what is to come. Is also a difficulty accepting personal responsibility for the disaster, because the mind is clinging to personal views about who we are and what our actions actually do with respect to causation. We do not clearly see our actions leading to this disaster in 80 years. It's impossible for us in some way because our species has existed on a planet that's been a certain way for most of our evolutionary existence. Our DNA tells us to expect water we can drink. It tells us to expect a climate we can live in. Our DNA tells us we can plant and there will be good soil. it tells us the ocean is an awesome place to go visit. It's great to go in, unless of course it's California where it's too cold. It's awesome, it looks beautiful, it smells amazing, it sounds amazing. We get a lot of food from it, and the ocean will always be there. We don't think of the ocean as a killer. I mean, literally, the ocean is going to swallow up pretty much every beach you know now. In 100 years, it will not be there. And many cities, like New York City, flooded. We don't have a frame for this. It's not wired into us. And just like Lenny said, we are not wired up to directly know this view of the reality that we're facing by 2100. And we are also not wired up, let me just say, to the idea that we are causing the death of our children and grandchildren. Human beings are not wired up like this. I'm sorry, we're not. We have oxytocin. We give birth to children, right? And we children have a long latency, so we love them. We love them like nothing else, and we will do everything we can for them for a really long period of time because we're dependent creatures, and we are wired up to love and care for our children and keep them safe. So like the whole idea that we are leaving an inhabitable planet to our children is unthinkable for us. We can't go there. It's not a view of reality we can go to. And this, according to the Buddha, all comes from the false view of me and mine. So the Buddha continues, not only Earth, but all other phenomenal experiences, all beings, everything that's seen, everything that's heard, everything that's sensed, everything that's cognized, all singleness, all multiplicity, the all itself, are also perceived by a non-practitioner as me and mine, leading to a view of self-clinging and forms of delight that impede true understanding and direct knowing of phenomena as they actually are. Now, a wise practitioner directly knows Earth as Earth. And doing so, the wise practitioner conceives attributes of the Earth, qualities of the Earth, and everything that comes out of the Earth without a view of me and mine. Why is that? The wise practitioner has gone beyond a self-possessing view of all phenomena and therefore understands them directly. However, a wise practitioner who also knows awakening. Now, this wise practitioner, just so you know, may know awakening either conceptually, or they may know awakening or enlightenment, like seeing it reflected, moon in the lake. But because that's the level of direct knowing they have of awakening, the wise practitioner still regards awakening as me and mine. And this self-possessing view of awakening creates clinging to and delighting in the experience of awakening, and that impedes direct knowing of awakening in its actuality. Take heart. Even a wise practitioner may have difficulty really grokking, really getting the enormity of an uninhabitable Earth, because the idea of that kind of enormity is still tinged with me and mine. So the Buddha continues. Now a realized practitioner, or the word back then was an arahant, knows all phenomenal experience, including awakening, as devoid of me and mine. And because a realized practitioner has gone beyond clinging to greed, hatred, and delusion, and directly knows the true nature of self and world in its actuality, the realized practitioner, the practitioner who has gone beyond the view of me and mine with awakening, has done so because that practitioner has recognized that suffering of me and mine will always come out of greed, hatred, and ignorance. So now think about global warming. The roots of global warming are greed, hatred, and ignorance. The greediness of thinking the Earth will always provide,
definite hatred and aversion toward having to be careful and share, go without, to view the earth as our partner, our mother, our sustainer, and not to kill her. That's the ignorance. That's the delusion we've been living under, is that we do not see our planet this way. Even now that we are killing it, we still don't see it. But a realized practitioner knows the roots of suffering. And then the Buddha continues. Now, a Tathagata, this is the word that was used for fully realized being, such as the Buddha. A fully awakened one directly knows all of that we've just said. And in addition, knows that clinging and delighting in false views is ultimately the root of every form of human suffering that leads to continued birth, old age, and death. And therefore, with the total fading away of craving, the Tathagata awakens to supreme, full enlightenment. So the difference between a realized practitioner and a Tathagata, and remember, all the monks are like going for the realized thing, you know? They all want to be an arahant. So like, that's what they're going for. The difference between these two things is that the arahant has gone beyond greed, hatred, and delusion. The Tathagata has a complete fading away of the entire need structure of greed, hatred, and delusion. These are two very different things, I think. When there is no need for greed or aversion, and there's no need to delude oneself into any view that is other than the utter, complete, and total way things are, that is full enlightenment. And this is the last line of the sutta. Displeased, the monks did not delight in the Buddha's words. Just think for a moment, what did the Buddha say that caused so much upset in the monks? I would love to hear from anybody who would like to proffer a theory about the displeasure and why the monks did not delight in the Buddha's words. Anyone want to take a stab at it?
I would guess that they're not ready to let go of me and mine yet.
I would guess that too. Anybody else?
They lost that hope that they could get there.
Yes, they lost hope that they would ever get there. Such is the rub. Remember, on one level, losing hope you're ever going to get there is actually enlightenment, right? It's going beyond craving for enlightenment. If you lose hope, right, you go beyond. On the other hand, it does really seem unattainable. So I could see how the monks would definitely be displeased. Not gone beyond me and mine, and hopeless.
I also think they don't want to lose hope. And if they, you know, if they take this seriously, they have to lose hope because they think they know and they don't know.
Thank you. So they have to lose hope because on the one hand, they've been told, go beyond hope and fear. On the other hand, they have lost hope because it seems impossible to go there. It just seems so unattainable. The problem here is delighting in. So why would the monks delight, right? It says the monks did not delight in the Buddha's words. So to delight in the Buddha's words, it would be a cause for suffering. I don't know about you guys, but to me, this is the way global warming feels. It feels like a lose-lose. Doesn't feel like a win-win. Or even a lose-win. It just feels like lose-lose. No matter what I do, my small little person can't possibly have much impact on this calamity that we are facing, which is the hopelessness, I think. Would you say so? Yeah.
But also you said, no matter what we as the human race do, we can't affect it because it's gone too far.
One of the things in computer simulations that is not, there's no parameter, I think, yet for
the ingenuity of human beings. That's not in the program yet, because we can't know what we don't know. So on one level, going beyond me and mine might actually look like I need to find a way to go beyond my hopelessness and commit to doing what I can do anyway. And at some point, if enough people on this planet go beyond selfishness and go beyond hopelessness and go beyond denial and delusion and their aversion to this whole thing, it's possible that we might be able to have some impact at some point. Maybe not in 100 years, I don't know, but maybe in 150 years. Maybe technology might be at a certain point where we might be able to have some impact. I can't know this. I am not a Buddha. On the other hand, I do know that I can, as best I can, try to limit my lens of me and mine, which might look like sacrifices. It might look like different choices. And I would do that because beyond right view is what connects and sets the stage for everything that comes after it in the Eightfold Noble Path. Right effort, right livelihood, right intention, right speech, right meditation, right concentration, all these things. Right view is the foundation, it's the core. So if I am having in my mind that I might be walking around at my stage of development as a practitioner, just knowing there's a moon, or I might be walking around at my stage where I can actually see the reflection of the moon. Either way, knowing the moon, seeing the reflection of the moon means that I'm attentive to when I am caught in greed, hatred, and ignorance, and doing whatever I can to not act on it, to check it before I do anything that might create more harm that's already been created. To me, this is the only way to go beyond hopelessness, to go beyond the feeling that I can't have any impact, to go beyond waking up every morning heartsick because as a 61-year-old, I didn't do anything for a long time to stop what's happened. It's my generation that's done this. We're the ones that got lost in our greed. We're the ones that were so attached to comfort. We're the ones that were so self-absorbed. And I have to find a way to live what moments I have left of my life not lost in all of that anymore. So you too might be displeased and not delight in the talk I gave. And I would be very empathetic to that point of view.